Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN 1210 on this January 15th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Thanks very much for tuning in and making this part of the program. We will talk to the folks from creditcards.com in the second half hour about the percentage of parents who are chipping in to help pay for their kids' bills. And then also we'll go to DeKalb in the second half hour, talk to Professor David Gunkel about just what's going on with voice-activated internet, things like that. How much does Alexa know about you? That's coming up later. But we start on Mondays with the folks from Chicago Inno. And I want to say a special thanks to Catherine Davis, who's in the studio, Jim Dahlke on a phone line. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Steve.
Dahlke, you there?
Steve, happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And you two are here on your holiday. You're not working today, and you both came in, so I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Catherine, did you did you drive, or did you take a bus, or how did you get here?
I took the bus, the 151.
Okay. Well, you got a piece on driverless cars in Chicago, or in Illinois, really.
Yeah.
That opens up some fascinating things. Now, Dahlke, you and I think, have joked in the past or talked about how Alderman Ed Burke has, and Beal, too, Alderman Beal, had this ordinance to try to ban driverless cars from the streets of Chicago. In fact, Catherine, you write about the Back to the Future movie clip made it to a city council hearing. What's that about?
Yeah, so it was a city council meeting last August where some Chicago officials were talking about how we should handle driverless cars here. And it was Alderman Burke and Anthony Beal who were like, we don't want these, and they tried to propose a ban, and they had this Back to the Future stunt where they're like, these cars could be used as weapons. So it was kind of an interesting way to...
So they were showing the DeLorean in Back to the Future? That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. All right, but the fact is, driverless cars, you know what? It's not even right to say they're coming, because in many places, they are here.
Yeah. In states like New York, Massachusetts, Arizona, companies like Uber, Lyft are working with Ford Motor Company, General Motors to deploy these kind of cars on the streets. They're testing them right now. But there's none of this going on in Illinois. A single car has been tested
here. And so, Jim, Catherine wrote the story, but I know you can answer the question. Why is that not a good thing for us?
Well, Chicago is, you know, this massive city where there's a lot of technology and innovation and culture. I mean, Chicago is a world-class city across the board, from everything from, you know, retail to food. It seems like Chicago should be in the discussion when it comes to driverless cars, and we absolutely are not. We're seeing innovation popping up across the country, whether it's Boston or Las Vegas or, of course, Silicon Valley, but even in the Midwest. I mean, Michigan, there's a lot of driverless innovation happening in nearby Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, and Chicago have really done nothing to sort of prepare for driverless cars. Like Catherine said, not a single test has happened on roads, not even in like a parking lot somewhere in Illinois. And meanwhile, in real city streets, like in Boston, there are driverless cars being tested on city roads.
Catherine, you wrote that General Motors is going to launch its own fleet, ride-sharing fleet, maybe next year?
Yeah, by 2019, they're saying.
Where's that going to be?
That's going to be in Massachusetts.
Okay, so, and that will be up and running, a full force thing.
Yeah.
All right, so the issue, guys, then, is that if it's happening elsewhere, and we're sort of reacting out of fear here, thinking the worst, mm-hmm. which isn't the right way to think anyway, right? Because driverless cars are safer than...
Yeah, I mean, there's data to show.
Driver cars.
Yeah, that like most accidents are caused by human error, and computers can drive better than humans. It's just kind of a fact at this point.
There was an interesting study, a question. I don't think it was with you guys, but there was a sort of a question posed. Do you wait for driverless cars until they're perfect, or do you bring them out when they're 75% there? Because even when they're 75% there, they will cut down on highway deaths.
Right.
So there will be mistakes made, but there will still be fewer deaths in the road.
Yeah, I mean, I talked in some of my reporting, you know, they were saying that, you know, if the engineers are working properly with city officials, then, you know, they can mitigate any accidents or issues, and it can be a pretty seamless outroll.
And Jim, it doesn't fit either with the fact that, I know the Emanuel administration has been very forward thinking when it comes to the smart cities initiative and things like that. And you have to be a smart city to sort of enable this fleet of driverless cars, right? It seems like there's a bit of a conflict there.
100%. Yes, it comes across, at least to me, it's sort of very strange. Chicago, not that they haven't even planned anything, but they don't really even have any plans for driverless testing. It's just not really even being discussed really on a legislative level. I mean, you look at these kind of innovations. I mean, it's a little bit of a different comparison, but look at Airbnb. I mean, when Airbnb opened, everybody was freaking out that, oh, you're going to open up your house to a serial killer, right? And that, like, by and large, right, has not happened, you know? So I think there's a fear anytime there's, like, a new, strange, disruptive technology. Oh, like Airbnb. Oh, wait, we're going to have, you know, psychopaths in our home. Oh, we're going to have these computer-driven cars that can be hacked, blah, blah, blah. When in reality, a computer-driven car is going to cut down on a great deal of human error. You know, a computer-driven car, it doesn't drive drunk, it doesn't drive tired, it doesn't drive angry. So, I mean, it really, in the long run, this is a public health issue.
All right, let's talk business then. So the city lagging behind, Catherine, it's actually costing it some business.
Yeah. So it was Navya. They're a France-based startup. They make fully electric autonomous vehicles. And they announced a U.S. headquarters here in Chicago, but then later backed out of that and decided to put it in Michigan because that state has more favorable laws for autonomous vehicles.
All right. So there's that. All right. Let's talk about Groupon. You know, Groupon is going to be back on the Super Bowl. And Jim Dahlke, they made a little bit of news today.
Yeah, that's right. So last month they said that they were going to come back to the Super Bowl, their first time with a Super Bowl ad since 2011, which of course was a sort of infamous Tibet commercial.
Timothy Hutton, right? Yeah.
Yes, got them a lot of criticism. It's typically one of the ranked as one of the worst Super Bowl ads of all time. So they are back with their first Super Bowl since then. And they just announced today that Tiffany Haddish is going to be the spokesperson for that ad and some subsequent ads even beyond the Super Bowl. So she's a breakout actress. She was in Girls Trip. She was on Saturday Night Live very recently. And so, interesting to see Groupon getting a celebrity face here for their Super Bowl ad.
Yeah, and it seems like she's a real Groupon user.
Groupon junkie?
Yeah, she says she uses it all the time, and she's the perfect person to be there.
All right, Tiffany Haddish. So I have to say, as an old guy, when I first read the name, I didn't know who she was. But then I did remember her turn on Saturday Night Live. I didn't see Girl Trip, but I did see her episode on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I saw Girls Trip, and it was funny. She was good in it, had some good comedy bits. So.
All right, well, good. So we'll watch for that, and that'll be in the fourth quarter, and that, Jim, will set him back about $5 million?
That's what NBC is saying, that NBC is reportedly averaging about more than $5 million for a 30-second spot during the Super Bowl. And, so that's what the running rate is going. And, yeah, check out the fourth quarter is when the ad will run.
It's just like the Wintrust Business Lunch. We could set him up for about that rate as well.
All right. That's right.
Jim Dahlke is phoning it in today, but I still appreciate that because he's got the day off. Catherine Davis is in the studio. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, and our talk with Chicago Inno is sponsored by Illinois Tech's Stewart School of Business, so we certainly appreciate that. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for spending part of your holiday, your day off with us. Appreciate that. Catherine Davis is doing the same thing. So is Jim Dahlke. They're both from Chicago Inno, and they join us on most Mondays. Dahlke wrote this story. Catherine, I want you to tell me a little bit about it, though, about this new, what's it called? Eternity Gardens. And this guy has an idea for a business of helping people find places to scatter ashes.
Yeah. So Eternity Gardens, it's an online platform that helps people find, that final resting space for ashes. And it allows users to search by the state, and you can filter through a ton of different criteria. So you could search by religion. And then if you wanted more of a natural setting, you can look at like air, sea, mountain options. So it gives you a lot of cool stuff.
We are more and more likely to be cremated than buried, right, Jim? I almost said buried alive. I'm sorry.
Like,
you there?
Oh, yep, I'm here. Yeah. So, Eternity Gardens is it's interesting, right? Because it sounds like, how often does anyone need this? It sounds like it's a really niche sort of idea. But
once.
Well, here's the thing, right? So in 2001, just about a quarter of the population chose to be cremated. Now, that's over 50% of the population is choosing cremation. And by 2035, three quarters of the population are estimated to be choosing cremation. And with the rising baby boomer population, there are a lot of folks here who could really use this. And so really the idea is, you know, if you are trying to find kind of the perfect spot to lay a loved one's ashes to rest beyond just, you know, keeping it in an urn, you know, sort of on the mantle or at your just like your basic cemetery locally, this is gives you the idea is to give you a lot of different options. So the idea was kind of from this entrepreneur whose parents said, hey, you know, scatter our ashes somewhere pretty. And he said, I'm not exactly sure where to look from there, and realized there really wasn't anything out there to help him do that.
Okay, so this is where I tend to be the old guy throwing cold water on these stories, because I'm not sure what he can offer that I couldn't, not me, not my parents, couldn't find on my own, right? I mean, if it's a national park or a waterfall or a scenic bridge or something, what is it that he's going to offer me that I couldn't do on my own and save my own money?
Well, so it depends, right? So there's different sort of like rules and regulations that depending on where you want to go and where you want to scatter. And then some things are just really important to people, right? Like some people, you know, a loved one might really want to have, you know, their ashes, you know, in a butterfly garden at a Jewish cemetery, right? So sometimes there are like sort of very specific kind of requests that, you know, a parent would sort of make for their kid. And really what happens is that you end up going online to try to like figure where this is. And Google just wasn't really an option for him. He was not sort of finding the answers he was looking for. And so what different cemeteries and different scattering places can do is pay to be included on the platform. And then they can sort of, in a lead generation sort of revenue model, send folks out to these scattering places and cemeteries.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how helpful this is, just because, you know, when people are thinking of places to scatter ashes, they're usually already thinking of somewhere that holds some sentimental value to them, like a lake that they used to visit all the
right.
time growing up, or, you know, a church that they went to regularly. So it'll just be interesting to see. Like,
I wish
how
him
much
luck. You know, it does sound also, though, Jim, like he's trying to or looking to sell the experience. I mean, that would include a boat ride out into the lake or a trip to here or there, right? That might be where he might be branching off into in the future.
Exactly. Yeah, experiences are going to be a very big part of this platform, and the more options that he's, you know, the site's going to be able to have, like, the more, just more useful it will be, right? So if it's something that's, you know, offering more sea options, more, as you know, scattering by airplane, I mean, different kind of things that are going to be meaningful to the loved one that they're trying to sort of, you know, represent, that's going to be key. So, yeah, experiences are definitely a big thing.
All right, it's called Eternity Garden, so good luck to him. All right, Catherine wrote a story about, I'm really intrigued by these common living sort of, it's almost like dorm living for young professionals, right? And there's a new one just opening up in Lakeview?
Yep, Lakeview East. And it's going to be operated by Common. They're actually a New York startup, but they've expanded here.
Do they have one here already?
Yes, that one's in Westtown.
Okay.
Near like Chicago and Damon Avenues. And that one's currently at capacity, which is kind of why they're like, we need another one.
So explain what these things are.
Yeah, so basically tenants pay a flat rent fee, and it comes with a fully furnished bedroom and then, of course, shared living spaces. So the new one in Lakeview has 14 bedrooms. So that's like how many people are in the house with you. But the rent covers all the utilities and amenities. And then you also get like additional perks, like someone who organizes community events for the people that live there.
It sort of, Jim, seems to me like you'd be living in an episode of Big Brother.
It's think about it like a college dorm. I mean, it's sort of like a dorm for adults. And you even have kind of like, you know, a community coordinator like you do like at a dorm, and you do activities, and you all share, you know, a kitchen, and you have, you know, you all split the cable bill within the rent. So I mean, it's very much like that. But I mean, the reason that this was, you know, it started in the Bay Area in part because, you know, rents out there are insane, right? And so, like, people are trying to find affordable ways to live. And especially, you can get a place here for as little as 3 months. So the flexibility is a big part of it, too, especially if maybe you're doing an internship in a city. Maybe you're not sure if you want to, you know, do a whole full year in a city. You can do it kind of like a smaller lease.
Okay, so Catherine and I were having that very conversation off the air because the rent, Catherine, is not a bargain.
Yeah, no, I mean, $1,400 for just a bedroom. I mean, you can get a $1,400 in Lakeview East, like a full one-bedroom apartment for $1,400.
So the key, though, is that you're only maybe committed here for 3 months.
Right, so you get that flexibility, and it's nice if you just moved to Chicago, you know nothing about where to live or the neighborhoods. This could be a good way just to get acclimated while you do that, but we'll see how.
Jim, I mean, is this, there seems to be a wave, right? Are we going to keep going this way?
We'll see how popular it is in Chicago. I do think that it makes more sense in cities like San Francisco, where like the rent has already sort of skyrocketed and gone out of control, and really, like, you know, these are the employees or folks that are looking for kind of shorter leases. We'll see. I don't know if the co-living trend is going to take off like co-working did. Chicago is blowing up when it comes to co-working. I don't know if co-living makes quite as much sense in Chicago as it does in some cities like maybe like Boston or Seattle or San Francisco. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it seems it's kind of attractive to me, I think, with the idea, though, that I would need a break on the rent. I mean, it just would have to be cheaper. I don't know that it would work for me if I'm paying the same as, Catherine, you are for a one-bedroom or something like that. I just don't know.
Yeah.
But again, all your utilities are in there too, though, right? So like your one bedroom, then you got to add, you know, heat and cable or internet and whatever else you're paying too. So there is some lumped in fees there that you're not having to pay.
Right, and I mean, if they want to watch The Bachelor every night, do I have to sit in the shared living room and watch The Bachelor with them?
Yeah, man, you got to make dibs on the remote.
How much do you guys, when you do these stories, you always talk about how there's like an event planner for each house. Does that really happen? Do people really go out and do things together?
Well, that's what they said. And, you know, it's a lot of the people that live there, they were telling me, are people who aren't from here. So people looking for friends, you know. So if you need some people to hang out with, it's great that they're already there.
Catherine Davis and Jim Dahlke, both from Chicago Inno. Read more about this and a lot more at ChicagoInno.com. Thanks, you guys, again. Appreciate it. Working on your holiday.
Yep. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, you got a kid in his 20s, or I don't know, maybe even 30s. Are you? Do you pay some of his bills or some of her bills? Apparently, most of us do. On the phone line now is Brady Porsche. He's a reporter at CreditCards.com. They did a survey. They found that 75%, almost 75% of parents of adult children are helping those kids with the bills. Brady, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming in, especially on this holiday. So there's kind of a surprising number to me. I know that people tend to help. Maybe it's because of the how young are the adult children? What was the age here? I mean, do you start with 18 or 20, or where do you start there?
18 and older.
Okay.
Is what we asked about in our survey, yeah.
So I would imagine that probably you're much more likely to help an 18-year-old out with some sort of payment than you are someone who's 28 or 30. Did your data look at that at all?
Well, Steve, it's clear that helping your adult children is a very common thing for parents today. I mean, our poll shows that 49 million parents with grown-up kids have chipped in for debts and living expenses at some point. The concern there is that you don't provide so much financial support that the child never learns how to manage his own money, or that you end up putting your own financial future in jeopardy or cause tension in your family. What's interesting is our data show that things like living expenses, say cell phone bills, car repairs, things like that, were more common sources of assistance than loans.
Yeah, I want to get I want to get into that a little bit about who's, you know, are parents doing it to help themselves or to help their kids in a bit. But let's talk about what we're paying for. And I think I interrupted you just as you did. So we're most likely to help maybe with a cell phone bill, but not a mortgage, which kind of surprised me because you think the mortgage would be a bigger expense.
Yeah, mortgages were only at about 6% in our survey, and credit card payments only came in at 16%, for instance. But on the other hand, 39% of parents said they helped with cell phone bills, and 36% said transportation costs, which in our poll means car repairs, gasoline, tickets, things like that. So that can mean that many of the parents we talk to are just helping their kids in college with day-to-day expenses,
right,
or say, you know, cell phone family plans are still a common arrangement. Also, the economy is on pretty strong footing right now, so maybe people aren't struggling with debt and don't need outside help with it.
It does seem, if you look at what the parents are spending the money on, that probably are the younger adults than versus the older. But the survey also showed that married couples are more likely to pay for their kids than divorced or single parents. Explain that for me.
Yeah, I mean, we found that, you're right, married people are significantly more likely than divorcees and never married parents to help their kids financially. It may just be that the married people, they have two incomes and they're in a better position to help the kids. Men are more likely to provide assistance. Women were more likely to say they had never done so before. Also, older parents tend to be the ones who help with debt payments, like you mentioned, mortgages, right, student loans, auto loans, while the younger parents, 35 to 54, for instance, are more likely to help out with things with living expenses.
You mentioned men. Men are more likely to pay for their kids' expenses than women, which I wonder if you surveyed people about that question, if they would answer it that way, because I think that kind of surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, the survey didn't quite dig into that. You know, it could be, you know, the idea that
well,
more
what
men.
You, what do you think? I mean, were you surprised by that?
I was a little surprised. You know, I think, you know, nowadays the idea that the man is always the breadwinner is not so much reality. So, yeah, I was a little surprised by that result.
Did you break it down by geography? I mean, where are parents most likely to pay for their kids?
Well, we found that one thing there was that people in the Northeast were more likely than, say, the South. And one interesting thing was when you talk about student loans, which student loan debt is a big part of this, it was more common in the Northeast than the other regions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got a lot of Ivy League schools there, maybe higher tuitions.
Well, yeah, Brady,
like that,
I so. Totally get that. I went on a couple college trips out to the East Coast. It's much more expensive out there.
And indeed.
And how old are you, Brady?
I'm 37.
Okay. So you're right in the middle, I would imagine, of all of this. The it's interesting to me some of the surveys that you cited or studies you cited about the assets held by young people today versus, say, 1989 and how we're doing now, the young people, versus 1989. We have not moved forward on that front.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting to note that many people who are young adults nowadays came of age during the Great Recession. So that was a tough time to start a career just because the job opportunities weren't as plentiful as they may have been in previous years. And even those who were able to find jobs may have taken lower salaries than they were hoping for just to get on their feet. And
right,
that might mean that may mean staying with mom and dad for a little longer than you planned. And if you're living with your parents and you're making a relatively small income, they're probably going to help you out from time to time.
You cited a study by Young Invincibles showing that young adult workers today earn $10,000 less than people of the same age in 1989. Also,
right,
the latter group owned twice as much when it comes to assets, the younger adults in 1989, than do young people today. You think that is probably mostly because of the Great Recession, that it just was tougher to get things started?
Yeah, I think it underscores the idea that today's young adults may not feel quite as bullish about their future finances as their parents did when they were starting out. I mean, you have to factor in things like student loan debt, the cost of living. The Federal Reserve shows that student loan debt is at about $1.5 trillion right now. Mm. And not coincidentally, student loans were the most common form of debt that parents admitting helping their kids with in our poll. It was 20%. You know, we also see a lot of young adults showing interest in starting their careers in the big city, like Chicago, like New
right,
York City, L.A. If you're tens of thousands of dollars in debt from college and you're paying rent in a big city with a job that may pay less than what you owe in student loans, then you may need assistance.
Yeah, people want to go to the glory. I mean, look, Brady, I've talked on this air last week. My daughter was just in Los Angeles last week. She's going to graduate in May, but she's already networking for a job, and she wants to go to L.A. And my biggest thing is if you go there, it's expensive. So then I guess the next sentence is, and I will bail you out. Wait a minute, I don't want to say that. but I'm interested in what you write about because, you know, we tend to think when we hear that three-quarters of parents are giving their kids checks, we think, oh, those lazy millennials or those lazy kids. But you could flip that and say, in a way, it's about the parents, too, who have been the helicopter parents and who are afraid to let go of their kids.
You know, Steve, it's only natural for parents to want to help their children and not see them struggle. And I don't think that stops when the child becomes an adult and strikes out on his own. If you're helping your adult child, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're dependent on you. You could be helping a kid through a rough patch in their life or occasionally lending a hand to a grown-up kid who's generally able to take care of herself. She has a career in her own home, things like that. But what you need to watch out for is that the self-sacrifice, got to make sure it doesn't exacerbate any financial or family issues that you may already have. For instance, you know, if you have other adult children, just be careful that the siblings don't feel slighted if one child is getting financial help and they're not.
And the kids will always find out, right? I mean, if you're paying off the son and not the daughter finds out, that's going to do some long-term damage, not just with you and your daughter, but between your son and your daughter.
Right. And, if you're the parent and you're helping your kids, if that's making it harder for you to make ends meet, causing tension between you and your spouse who may not be so keen on subsidizing the child, then it might be appropriate to talk about a timeline for turning off the spigot.
And so then, Brady, you're the expert. When do we tell the kid that they're on their own and that they're going to end up paying higher fees because we're not going to help them with their credit card debt?
Well, the experts that we talked to for the article recommend a timeline of about 6 months. So that's pretty reasonable. You don't want to just call up one day and tell them that the bank or the ATM is closed. If you do that, you can devise a plan with your child, and you won't end up feeling like you just left them high and dry.
Right. So you say you've got 6 months and they can run out and buy a car then right before the end of the month.
Yeah.
Brady Porsche, reporter at creditcards.com. Hey, great to talk to you today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, did you get an Echo, an Amazon Echo for Christmas? Is it sitting behind you right now? Is it listening to us? We'll kick that around next on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 1249. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, I'm the proud new owner of an Amazon Echo. I'm behind most of you, but ahead of the rest, because you're all going to have one day in one form or another. Professor David Gunkel is on a phone line. He's a professor of media studies at Northern Illinois University. David, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, nice to be on.
All right, am I wrong or am I right? We're all going to have something like this in our house one day.
That is what the prediction is, and in fact, if you look at what happened at the Consumer Electronics Show, which just ended up a week ago, these things are situated to take off in a big way in the coming 2 to 3 years from now.
So explain for me, because I have one, I like it, but frankly, I use it almost exclusively to listen to music or maybe to check a sports score or something. I'm living a perfectly normal or happy life without this stuff. Why is it that everyone is convinced I'm going to need it? Or I should say maybe that I'm going to like it so much that I'm going to take the effort to learn it and set it up so that it becomes a big part of my life.
Sure. So we can really respond to that in two ways. First of all, think of all the times that you have a question and you immediately pull out your cell phone and begin looking up something on Google or through one of the apps. This is a way of getting the same kind of functionality without having to take any object out of your pocket or your purse. You just ask a question, and the device automatically searches the internet for you and answers your query and gives you the data that you need. So there's a convenience factor that already is wired into how we behave with our digital objects.
Can I push back on that a little bit? Let me push back on that a little bit, because, and I want to love it. But when I look it up on my phone, it's more of a private engagement. So if I'm in a room with four or five other people, we're not pausing to listen to a machine tell us the answer. The other four can keep talking while I get the answer. You know, that's a little more intrusive that way.
It is, but think about the ways that you use your smartphone. It usually is when you're in conversation with other people and someone says, what's that actor in that movie that I can't, remember his name right now?
Exactly.
And you look it up and then you have to report what's on your cell phone screen to the rest of the people at the conversation. If Alexa is there or if Google Assistant is there, you can ask the question of the device and the device answers for everybody.
All right, so I'm sorry I interrupted you. I don't know if you remember your second point now.
The second point is, the bar for getting involved with these things is deliberately designed to be even lower than it is for a smartphone. In other words, if you can talk, you can use these devices. And so there is a way in which the device manufacturers are betting on the fact that voice control is going to be a more intuitive way to interact with our digital devices and the internet as a whole, and therefore won't have the same kind of learning curve that you have with other devices that have been introduced in the last several decades.
What exactly is this screenless internet? Or, I mean, how does it work? I know that if I'm searching again on my phone, I'm doing a Google search on my phone to find that actor's name. What's the difference between that action and how Google or Amazon is finding it with a voice search?
So, in essence, there's no difference. I mean, the device itself has very little smarts inside the smart speaker or the smart device that sits on your tabletop. The smarts reside in the cloud, right? So it's all internet-based search, and you ask a question, it searches the internet, and it gives you the response. The difference here is that instead of you having to type it in on a keyboard or you having to read it off a screen, we now have voice recognition that can recognize what it is that you ask, and voice synthesis, which can spit out to us in audible form an answer that we can understand just as, you know, another person would have spoken the answer to us.
Is that what made this possible? Not so much the computing technology. Well, I mean, it is computing technology, but the ability to be voice activated, the improvements there, that's why this is here now?
Pretty much, yeah. A lot of this has to do with a lot of recent improvements in voice synthesis for the output and voice recognition for the input.
All right, so sometimes just for kicks, I like to tell Alexa that I'm going to the library or that I'm reading the encyclopedia because I want her to get a better view of me than actually exists because I'm worried that she spies on me. How much does she actually spy on me?
Yeah, so there are some stories that have been published sort of raising a red flag saying these things are always on, they're connected devices, and they are watching you or listening to you at all times. That's not accurate. They only are on when you give them their wake-up word, like, hey, Google or Alexa. At that point, the device starts recording what you say, and that is where you have to be worried because what you say to the device is recorded, uploaded to the internet, and warehoused at Google or Amazon and can be data mined for personalization services, but also for advertising and other kinds of things that corporations do with that information.
So if you try to get Alexa to talk dirty to you, that's going to be on your permanent record.
Yeah, in a sense it will be. I mean, there are some controls built into these systems where users can go in and delete the history of what they have searched for and delete what Alexa supposedly remembers. But the amount of activity it takes in order to do that kind of control takes a little bit of effort and some knowledge of how to sort of tailor your own device and customize it.
So what we should be aware of is not what we're saying to our family when we don't activate it, but what we're saying to the Echo when we do activate it, because that is something that not could be used against us, but could be used by marketers and businesses to further target us.
Yeah, this is no different from what we do right now with a Google search or when we like something on Facebook. We are communicating our wishes, our desires, our ideas to the cloud service, whether it be Facebook or whether it be Google. And Facebook and Google remembers this. The internet never forgets anything. And the same will happen with regards to the voice-activated systems. What we say to them, they will remember. And they're doing it not to be nefarious. They're doing it to try to make the experience better. But inevitably, this data can be mined and utilized for all kinds of things.
So, David, in your life, are you super guarded when it comes to these things, when it comes to internet privacy? You're the expert on it. Are you sort of hypersensitive to all of that? Or do you have more of a laissez-faire approach that, like, well, this is part of the new world and some of my private matters are just going to be public? That's just the way things are now.
Well, I'm guarded. If there's something that I really want to keep private, I don't put it on the internet and I don't communicate it to my devices like Alexa or Google Home, because really there is no privacy on the internet. That's a myth. Privacy, if you really want it, you've got to disconnect.
Okay, so you mentioned, we've talked about Amazon, we've talked about Google. Are there startups in this industry, or are they pretty much dominated by those two? Samsung, I think, is involved too, right?
Right. So right now, Amazon has over 50% market share in the digital devices like the Alexa, the Echoes, things like that. Google made a huge play as a competitor this year at the Consumer Electronics Show, and they are trying to situate the Google Assistant as a direct competitor against the Alexa product from Amazon, and they're doing pretty well. Samsung is getting into the mix with something called Bixby, which is being seen on more and more of their devices, everything from their telephones to their televisions. And then you have these smaller organizations like Jibo Inc., which is the result of the work of Cynthia Brazil, who is trying to make the world's first family social robot. And the Jibo robot is a tabletop device that's kind of like one of these smart speakers, but it actually moves, and it has the ability to do nonverbal behaviors and do a little more interaction beyond just talk to us.
Professor David Gunkel, Professor of Media Studies, Northern Illinois University. Thanks for joining us today. I look forward to the next time.
Very good. Thank you.